The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Roberto, despite his Champions League record, world of football rocked by shock decision over Italian's future as Mancini stays at Manchester City. And Sunday he faces Chelsea, a club who said see ya loser to Di Matteo a whole 6 months after his triumph in Munich and 1 month after he was top of the Premier League. As Jellybean Benitez rolls in his stead, we ask, tough debut on Sunday, will there be a draw for the Rafa? Elsewhere, there's more Champions League news. That goal by Mexes, that goal by Luis Adriano, a buying Leeds story that's got nothing to do with Serie A, a Juve-Milan matchup that does. We hear from Sid and preview all the other big Premier League games this weekend, games like Swansea-Liverpool and Spurs-West Ham. All that and very little else in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello there. Yes, well, big week of news in football. Big pod panel. Today on Football Weekly Extra to discuss it, we've got Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
James Horncastle.
Hello.
And Owen Gibson for one part only.
Hello there.
Because you've got to get downstairs and crack on.
Absolutely. Owen. Busy.
All right, okay. Owen, let's start with fair, unfair. Di Matteo.
Does it matter if it's fair or unfair? Because that club's run by one man's whims alone. And,
right.
You know, I think most Chelsea supporters have long reconciled themselves to that fact, and I think the more that emerges, the more clear it becomes that Abramovich never really fancied Di Matteo, even having won the European Cup for him, and that his time was marked some time ago.
But he fancies Benitez more.
Well, that seems to be the case. I mean, he tried to get Benitez, of course, as a stopgap last year, and Benitez refused. I mean, there's something I think bound up in the fact that there was that intense battle between the Mourinho era Chelsea and the Benitez era Liverpool. I think he had that slightly disappointing last year at Liverpool, didn't he? And then Inter Milan, which didn't work for whatever reason. And but he's always had Abramovich's ear for whatever reason. And there's that sort of coterie of advisors around Abramovich with whom Benitez has always been in touch. I mean, he's always been lurking there in the background. There's all manner of people lurking there in the background at Chelsea as ever. Guardiola, of course, is another one who continues to be the unrequited love of Roman's life by the looks of it.
Avram Grant as well. There's reading reports today that he was again mentioned as a possible.
Extraordinary, yeah. I mean, yeah. Extraordinary. But I suppose the other thing for Abramovich is every time he's done this, it's sort of worked, hasn't it? I mean, he brought Avram Grant in. He got to the Champions League final. He brought in Hiddink, obviously, who did well, and then he brought in Di Matteo and won the Champions League. So from his point of view, every time he, you know, changes his course mid-season, it seems to work for him. Doesn't make it any less crazy, but.
Well, nice work if you can get it, Jacob.
Abramovich has this apparent desire to play beautiful football the Barcelona way. And Benitez doesn't necessarily have the reputation for playing great attacking football, though his Liverpool sides were very good. I think Chelsea, regardless of whoever would be in charge, would probably finish third this season. They probably don't have enough to really challenge the two Manchester clubs for the league. So if you want Guardiola and you bring in someone as with such a big reputation as Benitez and someone who has such a standing in the game, it seems kind of, or just a strange stopgap if they're waiting for Guardiola.
A stopgap with a stopgap, which does seem strange. And also that, as you say, you know, that longer-term project of getting Chelsea supposedly to play beautiful football, and you know, you think of Abramovich falling in love with the game when he saw that Real Madrid United tie and always lusting after Barcelona style of play. I don't necessarily think this takes that aim any further forward, and also Benitez surely is most likely to sort of rally the old guard, get Terry, Lampard, bring back Drogba, and so they'll be back sort of square one almost. You know?
And Fernando Torres, because the trump card that everyone's talking about Benitez possessing is the fact that he was the man who got Torres scoring.
It does show slightly how warped it's all become, though, as well, in the mind of Abramovich, if the reason for changing manager and bringing in Benitez is simply to service the needs of his misfiring, you know, record signing.
Barry, some stats. Fernando Torres has scored 2.75 goals per Chelsea manager. 8 Chelsea managers in 9 years has cost Abramovich 90 million, although that figure varies wildly. And one other one I saw tweeted, by the year 2025, it's been calculated you'll never be more than 6 feet away from an ex-Chelsea manager. that one is true. What was your take on this? I was stunned when I heard the news, but apparently I was the only person who didn't see this one coming.
Well, a lot of people claim to have been stunned, and I think it's like being stunned that Christmas comes around, or it's being stunned because it's your birthday. It's the same date every year. Well, what was stunning about it?
Well, he won the Champions League 6 months ago, and a couple of weeks before this, he was top of this league, and everyone had been saying he's finally brought the attractive, open, free-flowing football that Abramovich always wanted.
We've seen it happen before with Scolari. Scolari had that great start to the season. They were knocking goals for fun, and then as soon as things got difficult, they got rid of him. So there's no reason to suppose he wouldn't get rid of Di Matteo.
Plus, the timing's bizarre. You've got Man City on the horizon, and you've got a Champions League campaign, which although has been complicated, is by no means over.
But you're talking as if these decisions are being made by somebody who knows what they're doing and a very rational human being. He's shown, you know, it's his club, he can do what he wants. The fans may, you know, posture and blow, this is our club, we don't want Rafa, but and Abramovich has shown his utter contempt for what any of the fans think by appointing a manager they really don't like.
I mean, even Ken Bates, when he was on the verge of appointing George Graham, and the fact there was a mini fans rebellion, and even Ken Bates took notice of the fans at that point. But I think you're right. This shows that in modern football, there's no real place for what the fans think.
There's no real proof, though, that Di Matteo should have kept the job, because they got very, very lucky last season in a few of those games, and they've kind of possibly just the luck ran out this season.
Avram Grant did almost exactly the same thing, one spot kick away from
winning the Champions
League.
That's
clearly Abramovich's view. I mean, there's that moment, isn't there, where, you know, where he's finally won, they've delivered the European Cup, the thing that Abramovich has always wanted, and he goes up to him and he sort of yells, "I did it," and Abramovich sort of looks at him with sort of a look verging on disdain even at that point. So, you know, exactly.
All right. What I love about this is the fact that despite the fact that no matter how much he lusts after him, Abramovich, the one thing he can't buy is Barcelona's former manager, or indeed Barcelona.
And also the Barcelona's playing style. I mean, you would say after 10 years of Abramovich, there's still no further forward, you know, since Mourinho, no further forward in establishing a new way of playing. You would never, people would ask, you know, what's Chelsea's footballing philosophy? It would be very difficult to say what it is.
And also you could say the way they've acted over the last, 24 hours isn't going to endear them in any way to Pep Guardiola, because it just shows the short-termism that is at Chelsea.
Well, this is one thing that I find interesting. Were I a manager, would I be put off by the notion of going to Chelsea where I might have to work for, say, 9 months and then get an absolutely massive payoff, and then I could take as many year sabbaticals as I like?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's kind of win-win for Benitez, because he inherits a team which is, only 4 points off the top, 3 points off the top, four mm-hmm. 3 points off the top, with a world-class playing staff. And I think his patience has been justified. There's been, he's been slated for being out of the game and working on his blog for 2 years or whatever. And
on the Middle Eastern conference circuit.
This is the job he wanted, I guess, isn't it? This is the big club with the resources to match his ambition, and so, you know, turning down other clubs in the past hasn't been a bad.
Although arguably he's taken the stopgap role that he turned down last year, so he's been...
But in the meantime, at least in the same way that Di Matteo relaunched his own reputation by his time at Chelsea, because remember, he was the guy who'd been fired by West Brom, Benitez can possibly do the same.
And also, if you fail at Chelsea now, it doesn't really dent your reputation, does it? I mean, people will say, well, it's Chelsea.
Mm. Scouting Spain pointing out that Rafa Benitez started in Real Madrid, went to Inter, has now gone to Chelsea. All he needs to do now is join Porto and then finish up as a translator at Barcelona, and he'll have done the full trajectory. Very interesting. Of course, he's facing many of the same problems as he heads into this clash with Man City that Di Matteo was foxed by, i.e. a striker who doesn't and defenders who don't, Barry.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how he teaches David Luiz the fine arts of zonal marking, because that's a very much a Rafa thing. He's lucky in that his formation of choice is 4-2-3-1, which, you know, Chelsea have been playing anyway. People have made a great story of the fact that Fernando Torres scored a lot of goals under him at Liverpool, but it's not like Benitez discovered Torres. He scored quite a few goals before he went to Liverpool as well, for Atletico Madrid. But obviously he has the same problems as Di Matteo had, because it's the exact same team. And it'll be interesting how he overcomes him. Another problem he has is the fact that, as we mentioned already, Chelsea fans really don't like him because of his spats with Mourinho and the manner in which he's ridiculed Chelsea's habit of giving out those lovely little plastic flags to their supporters. So much so that there's actually a sign up in the Liverpool training ground, going, we don't, at this club, we don't need free plastic flags because our fans have passion. It'll be interesting to see. But, you know, fans are very fickle. If he does well in his first few games, I'm sure they'll warm to him.
Right. Do you think they're going to win this one? They've only had 2 wins in their last 8. But there's something about him going in there that... No? And Man City not looking like...
I wouldn't be hugely surprised if they won that game, no.
Man City?
There's something definitely missing from that Chelsea side. I mean, you saw it in the Juventus game. There's kind of, you know, the drive and the kind of, there's kind of will to win almost that the Lampard and the Terrier or whatever brings to that side. You know, they've definitely missed that. So I think the sooner, obviously, he gets them back, the better it'll be.
Well, by having to play Torres. Yeah. It's just rubbish.
Well, it was a really interesting aside in one of the papers this morning, which talked about the fact that, you know, even though the popular perception is that those three players were basically brought in to service Torres, actually most of his goals at Liverpool came from sort of long defence splitting passes, not from busy players who passed through the defence. So actually he was still a square peg in a round hole, and nothing you can do, and he seems able to bring him back to being the player he was, even, you know, and it remains to be seen if Benitez can do that.
Mm. Meantime, Mancini's got one or two issues, although second half against Real Madrid midweek showed them back to the kind of form you had expected all along, really, no?
Kind of, but again, they were correcting, had to correct the mistake he made. He started with 3 at the back, and as soon as they went, they conceded a goal. As soon as they went to 4, they looked more solid. At the same time, you could say that Real Madrid had a player sent off, and City looked the stronger team in the second half. But again, it's Mancini kind of overthinking things and being, well, outthought by Mourinho. And I think that's the risk, because there have been flashes of the City side from last season. And I think Silva's return, I think he was excellent last night, even though he didn't have that much of a telling impact on the game. But I just think, you know, regardless of the little time that Benitez has to work with this Chelsea side, I still think he's a better tactician than Mancini.
So, he was outthought by Mourinho, but it was just kind of Madrid's usual lineup, though.
Yeah.
You knew what to expect, though,
yeah,
from them.
But I guess again, it, to go back to the original point, it was Mancini overcomplicating things again by... Yeah, I mean, the change that he made, City were in much better stead, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
And so you could say that they were one goal down, essentially, and under pressure in that first half because he set his team up wrong.
Hmm. Well, 3-2 to Man City in the Community Shield back in August. Adam Coventry pointing out, with Dalglish and Di Matteo gone, the only trophy-winning manager of last season yet to lose his job is, of course, Mancini, curiously enough. Well, we'll be talking more about Benitez's time at Valencia, perhaps with Sid Lowe, when he joins us towards the end of the show. We'll also, of course, look at Tuesday night's game in Turin from the perspective of the triumphant Juventus, and maybe have a quick nod to their game with Milan at the weekend. Right now, that's it for part one. Many thanks to Owen Gibson for joining us. Catch up with you later, and for the rest of us, it's back after this. Right, well, other Champions League news, and excitingly for the next round, only 3 places yet to be decided of the 16 spots in the last 16. You've got either Benfica or Celtic, either Galatasaray or Cluj, or either Juve or Chelsea. And that's all coming up in 2 weeks' time. Of course, there's also question marks over who's going to finish top in their group and all that. Borussia Dortmund have sealed with another terrific performance, 4-1 away to Ajax. Don't they look strong? Top place in Man City and Real Madrid's group.
Wenger was saying on French TV last night that, ahead of Chelsea possibly being out and City being out, that, you know, it just shows that this times are changing, that English football is not what it once was.
On Monday night, I have to now watch Gary Neville every Monday, no matter what I'm doing. He was talking about pantomime football in England, saying that they've gone too far, that there's just too many goals now, and that's what's hurting them in European competition. Mm. You see it with all the teams. I think that if you put Arsenal or United into Chelsea or City's groups, they probably would have gone out as well. So they've all just forgotten how to defend. You know, we see these crazy scorelines every week in England, and everyone bangs on about how great it is, but then when they come into the big European games, they can't handle it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Too much perspective. Excellent. Man United, they lost, yeah, but they still won their group, whatever. They're taking on QPR this weekend, who've never won an away game under Hughes. They've never won a game, I think, under Hughes, something like that. He refused a request to resign. Johnny Late posting in, saying, as for Benitez at Chelsea, and this is vaguely relevant because Harry's mentioned in connection with Loftus Road, the only funnier appointment will be Harry's agent going too far with his Ukraine diversion in an attempt to flush out Premier League suitors. Harry's hangdog expression as he signs the dotted line will be a picture editor's dream. Certainly will. What are your thoughts on QPR, Barry?
Well, I'm not surprised that Mark Hughes refused a request to resign, because why would anyone resign if they're in the football management game? It's going to be a very expensive thing to do, to fall on your sword. But it's difficult to see QPR getting anything other than a good hiding at Old Trafford.
No.
Stranger things have happened.
Well, Norwich beat Man United, of course, last weekend. But
Norwich are a lot better than QPR.
There is that. Arsenal, well, they had a victory against Montpellier. They looked impressive in that game.
Yeah, and a nice goal for Jack Wilshere. Took it well. And then an even better goal from Lucas Podolski. Oof.
They've scored 8 now in 2 games. They're on fire.
Yeah, well, I saw Amy Lawrence this morning writing about Olivier Giroud, saying he's become indispensable.
She's writing about Arsenal, is she?
She was writing about Arsenal, believe it or not. But she was saying Olivier Giroud is now indispensable up front. And he was responsible for the 2 assists for Wilshere and Podolski. He got a lot of stick early on in the season, but I thought it was a bit unfair. He looks like a very intelligent player to me. Good movement, clever passes.
Thierry Henry could be coming back.
Oh, guff.
Well, at least Arsene Wenger refuses to rule it out. I'm not sure about
and
that.
And Drogba could be coming back to Chelsea.
And Drogba could be coming back. So. Fantastic. Bring back the 90s. They were much better.
Drogba wasn't in the 90s.
2000s. He was somewhere. But let's just skip 2000.
There's a great quote from Andy Roxburgh, the former Scotland manager who's now sort of sporting director at the New York Red Bulls. And he was, I don't know if he just wants more money or whatever, but he was saying they'd be reluctant to let Thierry Henry go to Arsenal because the off-season, when the MLS ends, it's important time for their players to regenerate, which sort of conjures up these images of players going through a Doctor Who-esque.
I think they go in a giant pod, you know, like one of those green things, and they just come out all fresh and sticky. Right. Elsewhere in Champions League land, Celtic lost at Benfica. A lot of build-up for that game. They blew it, but they do still stand in fairly good chance of going through, because they host Spartak Moscow in their last game, while Benfica have to go to Barcelona, which isn't going to be easy. Although Celtic, of course, have Wanyama suspended for the Spartak game.
They should. I think they're getting some injured players back, like Hooper and such like.
All right.
And they're playing at home, Parkhead. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, so Barcelona trashing Spartak Moscow. Messi has now got 24 goals in the season so far in 19 games for Barcelona. Many players will be happy with that at the end of the season, points out Filippo Ricci. Valencia held Bayern. They're tied at the top of the group. And in other news, in Chelsea's group, of course, there was that extraordinary Nordjelan Shakhtar Donetsk game. Why don't you explain what happened, Barry?
Well, one of the Nordjylland players went down holding their face despite not having been hit in the face.
Oh, really?
And the referee stopped play. The player, cheating Nordjylland player...
Are you sure? Did he really not get hit?
Morten Nordstrand, he took a bit of a shove in the chest and he went down holding his face, Rivaldo style. The referee stopped play because he thought he was injured. There was quite clearly nothing wrong with him.
You just watch too much hurling and curling, haven't you, really?
I don't watch any curling.
Okay.
You asked me to tell you what happened. I'm telling you, it clearly doesn't suit the narrative.
Yeah.
So you want me to give some...
All right, back to your version.
Fantasy
then.
Version.
Jacob, okay. Can you pick up the story?
Morten Nordstrand, the Nordjylland striker, was... horrifically elbowed in the
cruelly
face.
Cruelly and cynically.
Oh,
yeah.
Hacked down.
Yeah.
How he didn't die from this ferocious, horrific challenge remains a mystery to me. As he was so badly hurt, the referee stopped play. And, you know, because he was suffering from a head injury from this horrible elbow he'd got right in the face that didn't go anywhere near his chest at all. The referee stopped play. The player got treatment. So the ref went to have a hop ball to restart play. And Shakhtar decided, oh, we'll just play the ball back from, you know, inside our own half back to the Nordjylland keeper and he'll be able to kick it out and all the fannying around that goes with this ludicrous fair play nonsense. So one of the Shakhtar players played the ball back to the Nordjylland keeper, and while it was on its way back to him, Luis Adriano intercepted the ball and took it around the keeper and scored a goal.
Mm.
But then they said... all right, you can score a goal. Nordlund could score. They go
Luchescu said that he told his players to let them score.
But one player didn't get the message.
Stepanenko
stepped in and kicked the ball away. And then they scored a perfectly legitimate
goal after that. There was no letting of them score at all.
The interesting thing about that is I don't know if it's the best way to do it or if the referees need to actually step in there, because if that had been the Celtic Benfica game, a score draw would have sent Celtic through. So if Benfica had scored that goal that they didn't actually want to score, then they would have had to let Celtic score a goal that would have knocked them out. You know, it could have a ramifications elsewhere in the group.
I'm confused already. Let's just say that it was, apart from Chelsea firing Bobby Di Matteo, it was the most sickening thing in football this week, surely. And UEFA have brought a charge of unsporting behaviour against Luis Adriano. I'm surprised about that. Didn't know there was actually a rule about it or a law.
Is there a rule?
I don't know.
The referee. Surely if you give a drop ball and its intention is to give it back to Nordjylland and Shakhtar score off it, he should
blow his whistle,
shouldn't he?
Yeah.
He should do this. Come on, ref. I mean, it's common sense, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, they're very upset about that in Nordjylland, and I can quite understand that. But you're saying that it's nothing new, Jacob?
Well, no, it happened like 13 years ago. Arsenal-Sheffield United in the FA Cup, where a Sheffield United player got injured, it got kicked upfield, and I can't remember who it was, but which way round it was, but one of Overmars and Canu ran through and set up the other.
I think Canu
set up Overmars. It was Canu, I think it was his first game for Arsenal.
Yeah, so he claimed he didn't know the rules, and so Steve Bruce, who's the Sheffield United manager, was absolutely furious, threatened to take the players off, wouldn't play. I think the game was delayed for ages, and eventually Arsenal agreed to a replay. I think they finished the first game, but they agreed to a replay, and obviously Arsenal won again.
Right.
But all this nonsense about fair play, football is a cesspit, and these pathetic token attempts at pretending otherwise, you know, teams deserve to be punished for it. You know, Sid has a big bee in his bonnet about players putting the ball out of play if someone goes down injured. If they're down injured, tough. Play on, and, you know.
Long may you conserve that innocent outlook on the game, despite the many scandals you've been exposed to, Barry.
Yeah. As I pointed out already, Morten Nordstrand was cheating in the first place.
Was he? Yeah.
When he went down, because he hadn't been hit in the face.
Right, that's too complicated for me. I'm going to move on to Juve then. Now, we talked about Chelsea. And people saying, Di Matteo, did he get the formation wrong, etc.? No, he was beaten 3-0. He was beaten 3-0 by an absolutely superb Juventus side.
Yeah, I mean, I think the suggestion that Juventus were lucky because two of their goals were deflected in, and the third was a Czech mistake. Yeah, they outplayed Chelsea for much of that game. It kind of it was a real statement of intent, show of strength, I think, that Juventus were back. I mean, many people were saying it was their best performance in the Champions League since they went to the Bernabeu and Del Piero got a standing ovation. But at that time, they were still very much, you know, just coming back from Calciopoli, and they didn't have pretensions to win the competition. Whereas I think certainly on Tuesday night, they showed that they deserve, I think, to be considered as one of, yeah, certainly a dark horse, but for the competition.
Particularly if they sign well in January, is your point, and indeed many other people's.
Yeah, I mean,
get a striker on board.
The issue with the Juventus is that they create a lot of chances. I think they had more shots at goal on Tuesday night than any team against any opposition in the Champions League this year. And that's been the case. You know, like against Lazio at the weekend, they had like 29 shots, something, didn't score. They did the same against Nordjylland away when they drew 1-1. So the thinking is, if they had a finisher of 20 or 30 goals a season, like a Cavani or whatever, they would be a real contender. Mm. I mean, they're being linked with Llorente, who is in dispute with Athletic Bilbao, whose contract is up at the end of the season, and they could get him for, say, 6 or 7 million. And you'd think he'd fit for them as well, you know, in terms of Bielsa. But I wouldn't say Bielsa and Conte's football is the same, but they play a sort of intense passing style of football. So yeah.
Hmm. It was slightly harsh to call the first goal a deflection as well. I thought he meant it.
Yeah,
stuck out his foot and guided it in.
Well, I mean, the criticism of Quagliarello has always been that he scores great goals. He never scores ugly goals. Yeah, I think that it did look quite ugly, but it's probably intended. And he's been great this season when he's called upon. Yeah. I think only Messi has a better goal minutes to goal ratio than Quagliarella. Obviously, Messi's played a lot more. I think he's scored 7 in 7, Quagliarella. So,
woof. Hey, God, love that. And he might get 8 in 8 or even 9 or 10 in 8 this weekend. Because Sunday night, Juve are taking on rubbishy old Milan, who are languishing down in the wrong end of Serie A standings. Oh, but they also had 3 goals this midweek in the Champions League. A 3-1 away win at Anderlecht. What a goal by Philippe Mexès.
It was fantastic.
Rotten luck that he would do that a week after Ibra. If he'd done it a week before, we'd, you know.
Well, I don't know if we'd all be slavering over it because he didn't do it against England or an English team.
Right.
Hence, you know, his goal isn't being as celebrated. It could be argued his was better than Ibra's, but I'd go for the Father Ted at the lovely girls approach and said they all have lovely bottoms. But Mexès was being sort of, he had 2 men tight on him. The goalie was on his line, and he still managed to get a bicycle kick into the top corner from outside the penalty area.
Because that was the issue with Ibrahimovic. Goalie was way off his line, so...
Yeah. And Ibra was unmarked. But, yeah, 2 fantastic goals. There's also, you could also say Mexès is a defender and not a very good one. So he possibly deserves extra points for that.
Yeah, too. Absolutely. Well, that's going to be a classic game, isn't it? Of course, the big reunion with Andrea Pirlo for Milan. Mm. And, wow, I fancy it ending badly for the Rossoneri. James, what do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think they showed great character the weekend. They came back from 2-0 down to draw with Napoli away. Mm. They qualified from the Champions League group stage, which you could look at their group and say you'd expect that, but Zenit have been a big disappointment. So they've gone beyond expectations, I'd say, in the Champions League, considering everything they've been through. And a lot of that's down to El Shaarawy, the little pharaoh, who scored again against Anderlecht.
Isn't he a big pharaoh?
Oh, yeah, he's Faraone, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, okay. But
it was a Pharaoh goal he scored for the opener as well.
Yeah, but Galliani missed it because he was talking to Eddie Merckx in the stands.
Oh, was he?
Apparently, yeah. Cool. But, yeah, that was his that was his 10th goal, 12th in all competitions this season. And
I think, hang on, he's doing even better than Quagliarella then.
He is.
Yeah.
He's top scorer in Serie A, which for a 20-year-old is quite impressive. But... Berlusconi, he flew into Milanello the week to motivate his troops, and he told him to comb his hair better
because
he's got the crest.
Right.
And he's come under quite a lot of flack as El Shaarawy because he plucks his eyebrows in the dressing room, which when Gattuso was at Milan, he wasn't particularly chuffed about that. And he's a metrosexual man. He's very in touch with, you know, grooming and stuff like that, which is important to Berlusconi.
Yeah, absolutely. That wasn't the most upsetting thing that Gattuso's ever seen in a dressing room, as was revealed this week amid all sorts of Paul Gascoigne talk. Did you see this?
No.
Gattuso, who shared, I guess the two kind of coincided at Rangers, he shared a dressing room with Paul Gascoigne. He said one day he picked up his underpants to put them on and found they were unusually heavy. I'm not going to go any further with the story, because there it is. what a jakester. Hey, music and football. Van der Vaart next, picking up on our riff. God bless you, Van der Vaart next, because nobody else did. About music and football, and who might from the music world take over clubs. It's a Sunderland, Newcastle could be taken over by the White Stripes. Massive Attack could take over any club that Peter Crouch moves to. I like that. Graham Booth writes in with an important question. If Barry and Jacob were to play Conkers, who would win? What do you think, Barry? Jacob? Were you any good at Conkers?
No.
Were you not, Barry? I bet you were.
Well, I grew up in a house that had several very large horse chestnut trees.
Right.
Opposite it. So I know all the Conkery tricks.
What, just to clear this up for me, because there are a lot of urban myths about how to supercharge, to pimp your Conker. What was the technique? Did you soak in vinegar? Did you bake it in the oven?
Soak in vinegar and add a ball bearing as well. That's cheating.
How would you add the ball bearing?
There are ways.
No, but tell me them.
No.
You would insert it into the conker?
Yeah, you would insert the ball bearing into the conker.
Do you not compromise fatally the whole kind of integrity of the conker by inserting a ball bearing into it?
No, not necessarily.
You call football a cesspit, but, you know.
Nothing to conkers at Barry's. My word. Conker's Confidential with Barry Glendening. Leeds. Does anyone want to speak of dirty things? Hey, Leeds. Are they going to clean up their act now with this new Bahraini takeover? Who knows about this?
It doesn't inspire much confidence in me.
No?
Well, I mean, it took so long for this takeover to be completed. And for Gulf Capital, whatever, to show proof of funds and get the deal done. That I just feel they're kind of, you know, it's a false dawn. I mean, in many respects, it's great that Bates' ownership is coming to end, and he remains as president now, I think, for a brief period. But I don't necessarily see this as Bates handing Chelsea over to Abramovich. I think this is
it's more like the shape that Pompey dug up that time. That
well, Bates is still going to be chairman till summer because this thing isn't going to go through till summer, and then he becomes president, so he's still going to be there like a bad smell.
Well, more when we know more. Right now though, time for another bit of that music, and then we're off for a Premier League romp followed by Un Soupçon de Sid. What was your favourite cartoon when you were growing up, Barry?
Scooby-Doo.
Really?
Yep.
Jacob?
Yay!
That was Barry, by the way. Yeah.
Jacob, what was yours?
Come back to me, ask James.
All right, then. It'll be some newfangled thing none of the rest of us have heard of, anyway. James?
I had a few. Quite like Sharky and George. Remember that one? Yeah, with the pet detectives.
You know, Crime Busters of the Sea.
Crime Busters of the Sea, see?
No, I don't know anything about that.
Wacky Races, that was
cool. Oh, Wacky Races. Yeah.
Good. Pinky and the Brain.
What?
One was a
but I didn't get into that until I was an adult.
Right.
Animaniacs, they were good.
I mentioned this. Producer Ben reveals that, do you know, the Flintstones was the first ever American TV show of any kind, animated or live action, to feature a husband and wife in bed together.
And Sesame Street had Bert and Ernie, the first gay couple, I guess.
I don't think they were ever declaredly gay.
Well, no, I think if you watch it all back, it's like, oh, they are gay. They are gay.
Really?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sesame Street's success was that it had quite adult themes.
Right.
So the viewing figures were so high was because parents would watch it with their children.
Right.
And so if you look at it now, there are some quite strong social themes within it. Mm. Which
it's like Captain Pugwash, yeah?
Yeah, well,
it was bravely
what was
exploring
the social theme behind the Cookie Monster?
I think it wasn't he some kind of like, I don't know, junkie guy who kind of, you know, we had to all learn to accept and stuff like that.
Oh.
You know, drug abuse in society. We have to confront it even on a kid's show.
My word. Yeah. So there were social themes, serious social themes, actually running behind all the kind of idiocy. And much like this. And indeed, the next big theme that we're going to tackle is, of course, the Premier League weekend. Barry, you've got some interesting facts about one or two of the fixtures, haven't you? Fixtures like Aston Villa Arsenal.
Well, I don't really have any interesting facts. Villa aren't very good.
Yes.
You'd expect them to lose, but they were showing signs of life before they got hammered by Manchester City last week because they'd beaten Sunderland, drawn with somebody else, and then they'd gone 2-0 up against Manchester United before getting beaten.
What about Everton Norwich?
Well, this will be a stern test of Norwich's defence. They've kept 3 clean sheets in a row, but Everton score, I think, average 2 goals a game at home. So we'll find out now if Norwich's defence are really a force to be reckoned with or not.
Is there good form? Is it mainly based on games at Harrow Road, Norwich?
Yes.
Harrow Road. I live near Harrow Road, actually. Yeah. Hence the confusion.
They've got a couple of good away draws recently as well. But I was at Harrow Road for the game against United. Ooh. And they were very, very good, actually. They've got a nice midfield with Pilkington, Snodgrass and Houlihan. And Tetti, who's come in from the Norwegian midfielder, who's come in, he's given them a bit more solidity as well.
Tetti?
Alex Tetti.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, they're playing quite well, and hard game against Everton.
That means tits in Italian. Yeah. Do you know they could go into the top half if they win this?
I suspect they might not win this, though.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Sunderland are taking on West Brom, who are currently lying fourth, but could, Barry, could be third by the time the weekend's over. That's West Brom, not Sunderland.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Mm. And they probably will. Sunderland are on a winning streak of one game, and I don't expect them to extend it.
Ah, all right. Stoke, Fulham, other fixtures you can enjoy. Wigan, Reading. And then there are the biggies. The biggies like Swansea, Liverpool, eh? The Michu Suarez showdown.
Big Brendan going back to Swansea. I mean, they beat them in the League Cup at Anfield. I think that was 3-1.
3-1, yeah. And Swansea turning up at Anfield. But was that a full-strength Liverpool team they beat that night?
Joe Cole played.
No.
No, right.
But Swansea won this fixture last year. It was one of Brendan's great scalps, which probably went a long way towards him getting the Liverpool job. But, they're unbeaten in 7 in Liverpool in the league. So I think they've got 3 wins and 4 draws. I think things are slowly but surely coming together. They seem to have got figured out how to get the get the best out Suarez. I think he's supporting Suarez as well, which I think has been a problem in the past, getting people close to him and
except on celebrations, of course.
But I'd be surprised if they don't get a result.
All right. Of course, one of the dangers for Liverpool is that they're coming off this Europa League match Thursday night against Young Boys of Switzerland. Europa League, of course, such a spanner in the works for many Premier League sides as they head into the weekend's fixtures. And not only Liverpool, and I quite fancy Swansea's chances against them, but also, of course, Newcastle, who are at Southampton. Southampton are also on a one-game winning streak. Newcastle are very much not. They take on Maritimo. Yeah, they've won all their games at home. Newcastle, Maritimo haven't won any games away from home, and they haven't scored a goal away from home. So that fixture looks all right, and probably Alan Pardew just put out the reserves. But what about Spurs, who are going off to Lazio before their clash with West Ham, Jacob? Now, the Lazio game, a very delicate one, and in fact, before we didn't discuss it, really bad news again from Rome last night with another stabbing in Campo dei Fiori, the large square where people traditionally come together of an evening for a drink, and literally a drink, which you make last about sort of 3 hours or so. But the drunken ship, apparently, ten or eleven
Spurs fans.
Well, they were English, and there was one American as well, was taken to hospital with stab wounds. Apparently, about 1:30 in the morning, a gang of masked men broke in, supposedly ultras from Lazio, but they could just as easily have been from Roma, to be fair, because the Romanisti do this all the time as well. Lots of people writing in about this, and Alexander Bryant tweets, says, why are Romans so keen to stab English fans, often unprovoked? Are these attacks carried out on other nationalities? They do it on other Italians, but I don't think there's any tradition of attacking fans from, say, Eastern Europe or France the way that they go after the English fans, James. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a certain degree of identifying themselves with hooligan culture from the 80s. That's one
specifically
of
English hooligan culture.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there's this certainly on Lazio's part, but I mean that's one of the reasons why Gascoigne was so well loved at the club, was because they saw him as a hooligan on the pitch. But I mean in recent years it's been more a case of Roma fans, Roma ultras, I wouldn't say fans, but a specific section of their ultras being responsible for acts of violence against English fans, particularly sculacciando, you know, that's stabbing people in the bum. I think there was a lot made of when Roma played United, and United, I think, wrote an open letter which, you know, warned people to go to what were no-go areas in Rome. Just Campo dei Fiori, as you know, is a square in the centre. It's very friendly usually. It's full of Irish bars like the Drunken Ship, Sloppy Sam's, which is a US thing. So it's where people, you know, tourists tend to go, expats tend to go. So it's you know, it's a place where I guess they can be targeted, which is a shame.
Mm. The other would be the bridge leading to the Stadio Olimpico is an absolute no-no.
Why do they stab people in the arse?
Well, I think it's seen as it's not necessarily fatal,
but it's humiliating. All right. Well, in the meantime, anyway, West Ham await on the weekend, which is going to complicate a little bit Andre Villas-Boas' plans as he goes into this game. He does seem to be targeting the Europa League. Lazio are top of the group. We can't talk too much about the game because it's going to be played by the time most people hear this. So what about West Ham? One defeat in 6 for the Hammers. And they're indeed above Spurs on the table now, Jacob.
Which is quite odd, given the context of the last few years. But they've, to be honest, they've been pretty abject at Spurs for the last decade. They've tended to get a very good hiding there. They haven't won there since 1999. And to tell you how, you know, give you context of how long ago that was, Ian Wright scored for West Ham that day.
It's almost as long as Spurs hadn't won away to Manchester United.
Yeah, well, that's not. Yeah, that was longer. But Spurs still have some very, very good players. You know, everybody's going to struggle to handle the likes of Gareth Bale, but they will be without Adebayor. And Villas-Boas is not particularly liked, I think, by the fans. They're not playing very well. They're struggling in the league.
I think they've really missed Dembele. I think
he's back.
He's
definitely
supposedly
back.
Supposedly, yeah.
But ever since that Chelsea game where Dembele was ruled out with his hip injury and Bale had to go and attend the birth of his child, the wheels have kind of fallen off. And I think that was because Spurs were quite highly strung. They had a tightly wound, highly strung, yes. He seemed to have found his best team then, and then since then he's not been able to play it. Mm. And I think you can chart that with this recent run of poor form from Spurs, to be fair.
All right.
Andy Carroll was in a bit of a mood on Monday night. He was effing and jeffing at Sam Allardyce when he came off.
Why was that? Because he was taken off.
Yeah,
right.
Well, with about 5 minutes to go against Stoke. But again, you know, he played okay, but he hadn't threatened a goal at all. And I think that's now 8 games that he's gone without scoring for West Ham.
It's quite funny actually to see a player going that mental when they're taken off, when they've had, you know, 7 games in 85 minutes to score a goal and not manage it. Oh, I was just about to do it now. Mm. I was going to get 3.
It's a good sign, though, isn't it? You want your players to be upset to be taken off. I think that's right, isn't it?
I quite like him, but I cannot believe, now watching every week, that they play $35 million for him. It's just staggering.
Well, okay, so you're not quietly confident for the Hammers at Hart Lane.
It's not a happy hunting ground.
No, okay. Barry, what do you think? Have you got any funny feelings, the way you had that funny feeling last weekend about Sunderland at Fulham?
No, I don't.
Nothing at all?
Nope.
All right, James?
What, anything?
Anything you think about the weekend? Any little tip?
I think
QPR might...
Yeah, QPR will lose. I was going to say, might snap something like that.
You're prepared to go on record with that, are you?
No.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. That's the Premier League weekend. It only remains for us now to stick 10p in the slot and dial up our chum, Simon Lowe, Dr. Simon, a.k.a. El Cid, in Spain, with some very exciting news. Cid, it's so exciting to hear from you. Many questions to ask you. First of all, when clever people talk about what kind of football Benitez brings to Stamford Bridge, they mention Valencia. What kind of thing do they mean, and how well does it tie in with the personnel at his disposal?
I think it doesn't particularly tie in with what Chelsea have got at the moment. If you look at that line of three behind the forwards, that's not really the way that Benitez has played, although he has tended to play 4-2-3-1, so he probably would like a line of three. But his certainly at Valencia, his team was above all very, very intense. They were relatively direct, they were very quick, very, very athletic, and above all, they were a side that never let a team settle at all. And I mean, you know, to some extent we saw that at Liverpool, certainly that year when they were close-ish to winning the title with Gerrard just behind Torres. And I think that was a fairly accurate reflection of the way that he generally tried to play when he was at Valencia as well.
Mm. It's interesting signing this. Has there been a lot of reaction in Spain to it?
Yeah, of course there has. And this is something that, I mean, the Spanish, you know, as a general rule, follow English football quite closely. They're genuinely quite interested in it. And this, I think, has surprised a lot of people for the same reasons it surprises people in England, because of Benitez's Liverpool history, because of the fact that he's accepted what appears to be a short-term contract, which looks a little bit, perhaps a little bit desperate, perhaps a little bit surprising. But yeah, this has been picked up on here. And of course, the assumption is that Benitez will do enough to maybe keep the job for a little longer.
Mm. All right. In other news, Cid, Dom Tal posts in saying, is it possible we could please ask Cid about his thoughts on the richest man in the world buying Real Oviedo? I mean, if all those £10 shareholders want their money back, or is this exactly what the whole project was about, showing an investor the global reach of the club?
It depends if you want the long answer or not, and I don't want to bore you to tears.
Well, but, it's your battery I'm worrying about.
But one thing that's really significant, I think, is that while Carlos Slim has come in, his shareholding is, I think, around about just under 40% of the club. No, it's less than that even. It's close to 30% of the club. There is a greater percentage of the club's shares owned by fans than there is by him. So I think that's one of the I think one of the most positive things about this whole share issue is that collectively the fans' voice is still huge and will I think be heard.
Oh, that's excellent news. And does it mean they're now safe anyway?
Yes, it does.
All right, excellent stuff. Excellent stuff. One final thing for me, I don't know if there's other things you want to bring along, would be, I hear you've prepared your own rival video treat for Guardian viewers. You probably sat there with a cake and a coffee, and what are you talking about?
I do like to sit there with a cake and not a coffee, a cup of tea. I'm on the train now on my way back to Barcelona. Video was done in Barcelona last week, and basically it's a piece to go together with this series of articles that the Guardian's doing that mark the elections that are coming up and the move towards Catalan independence, and it's about looking at what Barcelona's role is as more than a club, what they mean by that.
Right, and who have you spoken to in the video? Right, and then, you know, yeah. I can reveal that he spoke to Johan Cruyff, because he mentioned that the other day, and also to Juan Laporta, and loads of other star names. Sadly, at that point, a tunnel came by, Barry.
Or his battery ran out.
Or he just decided, you know what, I've had enough. Had enough of this nonsense. It's a shame, because I was just going to ask him, because one of our listeners tweeting and saying, how would the Catalan vote affect La Liga, you know, Barcelona, Espanyol? But it's not here to tell us anymore. I guess we'll just have to go to the Guardian website and watch that film to find out. And while you're there, if it's after midnight on Thursday, you can also check out my own far less exotic and sociologically significant effort, which will involve a couple of hastily printed off headlines and that kind of thing from the week's continental papers. What did they say about evil Luis Adriano and his goal of malevolence and all that kind of thing? I don't know. I'm going to go and have a look in a second, and then I'll tell you. Good. Anyway, that's it for today's Tip Top Podcast. Many thanks to Owen Gibson, to James Horncastle.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. Jacob Steinberg.
Thank you.
All right, and Barry Glendinning.
Thanks, Jimbo.
And also you, producer Ben, and you, of course, listener. Thanks ever so for joining us. We'll be back on Monday. If you care to do it all over again, have a super time. Until then.